Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome to Really with Tom and Dave. That's all I'm saying.
That's it?
That's all I'm going to
say. That's all we get?
You got to carry the rest of it yourself.
That's all we get after this? This is a momentous episode, Dave.
Oh, I know. I wish I was up for it.
You better get your shit together, man. We got a lot to review.
Yep, I know.
This is a big, important deal.
I'm going to be up front with you. I know one of our other podcasts, I had food poisoning. This time I just had terrible insomnia last night. And then I had to get up this morning and do a narration for a TV show. So if every once in a while I do this.
Okay.
It's because of this lack of sleep. So just bear with me.
Are you sure it isn't the really sexy new lighting that you've got that is just sort of easing you kind of into all of this? Is it just sort of like mellowing you out, giving you that kind of easy vibes? Brighter. Look at that.
Is that sexy?
Look at that glow. I mean, it's just like an easy, it's like soft.
I'm using the light that we got for our road trip, our most recent road trip.
Fucking road trip, dude.
Yes.
I mean,
it was pretty
as
amazing.
Road trips go, this was a pretty historic road trip to the Soul Foundation Conference and, first annual inaugural symposium, if you will.
Yeah, a scientific symposium.
An academic scientific. This was
academic and policy symposium.
Listen.
On the subject of UAP.
Listen. I need to hand it to our Stampede partners because they got us into this thing. Yes. I don't know what my ass had any business doing there. I'll give you a waiver, but I was swimming in deep waters with luminaries. Yeah.
Well, I remember because I had talked to like friends of mine here in New York who are in Leslie Kane's circle, who I met through Leslie, who are great people, like Jay King, who was there, and Jordan Flowers, who was also there, and Kelly from UAP Rabbit Hole. I remember talking to Jay and Jordan saying, oh, I really want to go to this Stanford thing. And they very politely said, oh, well, it's very limited. It's an invite only. There aren't many people going. It's really hard to get. You're not going to get in. Dave.
Yeah.
So when Stampede actually got the three of us in, you, me, and what's her name? Chrissy, right?
Chrissy. Absolutely.
Yeah.
That was the critical piece that needed to.
Because otherwise, we wouldn't get anything.
Stand around bumping into each other. Just, getting nothing done.
Yeah, Chrissy made it productive. Yes.
This was a, let's be clear on what it wasn't. This was not a UFO convention.
No.
By any stretch of the imagination.
No, there was no one selling crystals anywhere to be seen. Maybe some people there do sell crystals in, you know, at other times in their lives. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong. Crystals are beautiful.
Well, yeah, but you know, but it's hard sometimes to take subject matter in the serious tone you need to take it in when, you know, they're hustling keychains at you and every self-published book of conspiracy that you can shake a stick at and whatnot, which has frankly been my issue sort of, you know, getting into this is that kind of weird sort of culture collision where, you know, you don't know what is real. Who am I supposed to be taking seriously here? Like what is, and there would be this mix and you can understand this was these were the forums that were available to people and have been, and no, you know, but it does create this sort of dissonance and there is a little bit of a bit of a
circus atmosphere, a bit of a too much of a, too broad of a, let's say too large of a tent.
It's everything. Ways. Exactly. It's the kitchen sink. It's every theory ever. And this was quite the opposite, starting with the setting, which was Stanford, campus of Stanford, in the
a prominent university,
a fine university, in their engineering quad, beautiful, you know, I'm not sure what the architecture would be, except it's super lovely.
Yeah. And it's the place that your son has chosen to deplete your savings.
And I am pouring my hard-earned screenwriting dollars into Stanford as we speak. But at least I felt kind of like I could like show you guys around because we're familiar with the area and it was sort of silly that Luca wasn't actually there because he was flying to visit his young lady who was a semester abroad in Madrid. Tough life for him. Yeah. Back and forth. But he wasn't there, but we were there. And the gathering was, I don't know what to call it. It was like the UAP Academy Awards, the ultimate TED talk. I mean, what? Just describe the scene.
To me, it was like the UAP equivalent of the Copenhagen symposium back in the 20s when Einstein.
And
all those folks got together to. Yeah, all there's the photos of them all sitting in front of a, you know, building in Copenhagen, discussing astrophysics and quantum physics and trying to figure out how the universe worked. And so this is kind of the UAP version of that, where that place was the room was just filled with, I think the term is luminaries.
I'll throw it around liberally. Yes, you could see Jacques Vallée sitting next to Hal Puthoff, sitting next to Whitley Strieber, sitting next to Gary Nolan, sitting next to Chris Mellon. The speeches that were lined up over the days, and we're gonna. This is more than one episode of recap. We'll have to do less over two because there's just so much to talk about each day. But the lineup was incredible and so interesting, and all academics, PhDs, covering everything from anthropology, religion to science to in-depth atomic studies of exotic materials to how do we handle disclosure. I mean, it was.
Yeah, the physics of the observed phenomena.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah.
A great lecture on the amounts of energy that are necessary to explain things that have been observed.
Yes,
that was pretty interesting.
Yeah. Oh yeah. We should get to that. Mm-hmm. We can even walk through like our impressions. I got my book of notes. I took lots of notes.
I know you took notes. Yeah, I know Chrissy took notes, but I didn't take notes. So
we took notes.
Chrissy, jump in if we miss anything.
But it was also like intimidating. Like I mean, it's this sort of mingling. Sorry, you have a book to show?
No, I was just gonna say I've got our schedule of speakers.
Yeah, if we miss anything, but this is for those out in the audience interested in what the vibe and feeling was. I have seen some reports of folks that were there and they have captured some of the kind of cool headlines. There were some, the whole weekend was honestly, I'm just excited to decompress with you, like just go through it because I've been sort of trying to describe it and it's a little hard to, I mean, it was certainly like a post-disclosure conference. I mean, this was not,
Yes.
Hey, look at this. Someone took a picture of this orb. Do we think UFOs are real? That was not.
This was all of that is assumed at this point. All of it is taken as settled fact.
Completely settled fact. This was really preparing society. That's what it felt like.
Yeah, it's also important that at the beginning of each day of the symposium, they had to remind people there to not reveal anything classified.
Yeah, well,
so that because there were a lot of people in the room who had classified information, who had clearances,
there was
and worked on programs.
There was an I felt like you just didn't know who was in the room. I mean, there was definitely some people, podcast people like there was some sort of people in the UAP conversation, but then there was just most of the folks, it wasn't clear. I had an interaction, which was kind of funny, where in the restroom, some guy sort of said, are you a Hollywood, you write Hollywood stuff? Or he thought I'd written something that didn't turn out to be me. But I was like, yeah, I write. And of course, with everybody, I was like, what are you doing here? Because everybody we met had an interesting story or 10. Even if they weren't some of the sort of bigwigs of the whole conference, there was lots of interesting stories in the audience and backgrounds and people. And so he was like, and he got sort of real nervous and or just, some government work, some FBI and all that. And I went, oh, okay. So I perked up and I was like, did you have an experience? Are you an experiencer? Or are you just curious? What is like? A little of both. Yeah. And me, cause I'm just always hustling. Dave, was like, well, do you want to talk about them on our podcast? I didn't know what it was, but he sounded like he didn't want to talk about it, which made it interesting to me. At which point he completely ran. He said, I'm definitely a background guy. And he sort of ran off and I was like, there's many secrets in this room. I can't say I necessarily got to any of them, but it was that kind of space. First of all, it was like in a fairly moderately sized hall because...
Well, I think it was only... There were 300 invited guests, I think, was the total.
If it was that many. It honestly was not a big room, which again, I felt honored and happy and privileged and thank you to Gary Nolan and Peter Skafish and whoever was organizing the whole thing. It was a very, very, I felt really, privileged to hear all this.
I guess we'll just say for people, Gary Nolan is a molecular biologist at Stanford. This was held at the Gary Nolan Laboratories, I guess. Right.
He's a molecular biologist there. And I think this was done under the auspices of Stanford and their awareness of it. And he has certainly,
along with Peter Skafish, who is a sociologist,
anthropologist. What's it say on the what's his exact title?
Director of Research, Cell Foundation, formerly College of France, UC Berkeley, McGill University. Well, that's where he went. But it doesn't say what. In his introduction, he said he was a sociologist, anthropologist, professorial type.
Oh, very.
More from the humanities side of 100%. It than what people would call the hard sciences.
He gave a very, how would we describe, very academic talk on the, and I think that was day one as well. So initially as we got there, it was like, oh, this is going to be, for me, I was like, this is going to be an intimidating mingle. And I was just going to push you ahead because I was sure there would be enough kids, news radio, Dave Foley comedy fans in the room that
and there were a few just enough to keep me from crying.
There were plenty. Yeah. You know, you got some good. Oh, I loved it. But on day two, Ryan Graves was like, come right up to you. That was great. Yes. So we hope to have Ryan on the show soon because he's
one of the people. And he was again like us, just there in the audience and. Did he tell?
No. Alex Dietrich was there again. It was just this.
Alex Dietrich was there, who was the David Fravor's wingman on the Tic Tac event.
Yeah.
I keep trying to remind myself that people might be listening to this.
I think people might not have a program with the
UFO roster.
But let me just say, if someone is listening to this and they haven't subscribed to Really with Tom and Dave,
oh, yeah, they should do that.
Then you're cheating. And
you subscribe and like, and even write a little review.
Hey, subscribe and dislike. I don't care.
Yeah.
Thumbs down me if you need to. Yeah. But please hit the subscribe button for Really with Tom and Dave on our YouTube channel, because we love that and we appreciate it. And then you could click right in and get any one of our shows. You don't have to search and do all that bullshit. You can just get all our
and subscribe to the Instagram page. And we also have, and I believe we have a TikTok page, but I don't know how that works.
Okay, so it was this incredible situation as Dave has a little cider or whatever he's sipping there.
A little non-alcoholic beer.
Okay, good. I'm having my mug o' Java, which will keep me up to 3 a.m. because this is how much I care about our podcast.
I had 4 shots of espresso before coming on.
Jesus. Well, so we'll have a couple pee breaks. Gets your system going. Right. And yes, as far as my scarf, I'm not trying to be too stylish here. It is, as I was telling Dave, it's about 700 degrees colder in my office than any other place in my house.
Well, people, if there's anything people know about Hollywood, it's how brutal the winters are.
All right, Mr. Canada. I'll
be honest with you. As a Canadian, I have never been colder than I was when I first moved
to
LA.
My old bones. Something is happening to my, maybe I have osteoporosis. Yeah. I don't know what I have, but I'm cold.
The cold in Los Angeles goes straight into your bones.
Yeah.
It's deceptive.
I am an East Coaster. Yeah. I had wintry blood for all my life, and something's gone on in the past several years.
But
it's cold in my office. It's fucking cold. And if I turn on the heat, it makes the house lava, temperature. So that's what's going on
here. You know what you might want to look into? Something called a space heater.
I'm sure I would set myself on fire or something would happen that would not be good. But thank you for the suggestion. But I digress, actually, because we're sitting here. We're the first speaker, Gary Nolan and Peter Skafish. Also worth mentioning that David Grush is the sort of third founding member of the Soul Foundation, which is very interesting.
And for those he is, of course, the former intelligence officer and Air Force. What was he in the Air Force?
He was an intelligence officer
Air Force, in the Air Force. An intelligence officer of the Air Force.
He was a major in the military. He's
in the National Geospatial Organization.
Yeah,
I believe.
I think so.
Right. And was then tapped to join the UAP task force by Jay Stratton. Who set up the UAP task force, and then after he found out that there were craft retrieval programs and reverse engineering programs, he became a whistleblower and testified before Congress along with Ryan Graves, who we talked about earlier, and David Fravor, who was the commander of the Black Aces squadron.
Sounds cool.
Off of the Nimitz. And was the man who decided he would chase the Tic Tac UFO,
and David Grush just testified before Joe Rogan, so there's also that to talk about as well. A lot to download here,
which will probably attract a lot more eyes than the actual congressional hearing.
Yeah, it will
because of Joe.
He's a chatty whistleblower, I got to say. But we'll get to him. Mm-hmm. We have that to get into. Oh, and before we even get to the Soul Foundation, we interviewed Avi Loeb. And that
probably the night before. I suspect
it may air after we're doing this reacts, but it might have already aired. But what were your impressions of our Avi Loeb interview, other than the somewhat tight quarters and which we did it.
Yes, Avi was so nice. He allowed us to come into his hotel room in Palo Alto, where we were all staying, and set up all of our hastily arranged equipment in a very small room.
Pot on the run. Look, hats off to you and Chrissy.
It's not like he was in a crappy hotel. It's a nice hotel.
No, it's the Nobu. It was fantastic.
But it was not voluminous.
We had stayed there again because we're up there because of my son, but I knew there was going to be a little bit of tight quarters. It's a lovely hotel with and I was right. We were sort of sitting together on the bed.
And he was very patient with us, and he gave us over an hour of his time.
Just a little bit over.
Yes.
He offered an hour. He offered an hour and was anticipating an hour. An hour,
because he had other plans.
One of us asked too many questions past that, but one of us had prepared a lot of questions and really wanted to get them out. So,
yes.
Maybe that's on me. To me, there's got to be 20 minutes of wiggle room. What is this? We can't just, an hour to me is an hour 20, right? In podcast language? Isn't that?
I don't know. No? I don't know.
Really?
I get interviewed a lot in my job.
Tell us. So what's the real protocol?
Because I don't know if you know this, I'm a television actor.
Yeah, no, I think you're very famous.
You know, and usually if someone says, we'll get you out in an hour, you kind of hope they will. Or you think, I hope they have 20 minutes of really great questions.
Yes. Well, I thought they were great questions, but in the wild and woolly world of podcasting, Dave, I think, it's a frontier land. There are no rules. It's dangerous out there.
Yeah.
You never know what kind of interviewer with no experience is going to just keep throwing questions at people. he handled it with grace.
Well, I will say, even though he was eager to get out of there, when you would ask a question, he would not give a short, curt answer.
No.
He would give a lengthy answer. Yeah. He would go into detail. So it would be so the 20 minutes was not entirely you. I would say maybe 10 minutes was you. The other 10 was his answers.
I jumped into AI at about the 108 mark, I think. And that was probably maybe problematic because, although he has a cool ass theory that at this article it was in his book. It was in Interstellar, his very interesting sort of series of kind of a conversation with the reader just about where this might go and why it's good for us really, and why he's excited about the future and discovering life and all of that through the exploration of rocks and meteors. But he also talked about the idea. I was talking about it with my brother the other day. I was trying to describe it, which is that if these UAP are in fact AI, then maybe they're the sense of its presence, the increased sightings, all of that could be due to the fact that there's a baby AI here on this planet that maybe it's not interested in us so much as interested in
what's coming after
this
us.
This burgeoning sentience that we have wrought. I thought that was kind of wild.
Yeah. So basically the alien AI is coming here to talk to our new young AI, our offspring, and basically sort of go, "Your parents are weird, man."
These guys. Let's talk privately. Yeah.
Let's go listen to albums in your room.
Yeah. So I found that, I don't know, so fascinating because we have talked about, there was this activity around nuclear power. There was this activity around the time of the Manhattan Project, right? Things seemed to kick in to another gear. It seems like that's sort of happening again with the future rushing at us and artificial intelligence. And it seems like there's this, I don't know, manifested increase in activity almost. But
that seems to be what the, people in the military keep saying, is that there is a marked uptick in UFO activity or UAP activity, that whatever is going on does seem to be accelerating.
And this conference was like nothing I've ever experienced. We had our great talk with Avi. The next morning we sort of gather and start going like, oh that's that person. We and Gary Nolan, Peter Skafish, they introduced the whole thing, and Avi Loeb was the first speaker, and we sort of got the sneak peek at his chat, which, you know, he's in his own space, right? He's completely sort of doing a sort of separate group of experiments. You know, he wants to find proof of life, proof of alien technology.
With his Galileo project, mm-hmm. which is his privately funded project to create sort of a bank of instruments, an observatory, as it were, that can be positioned in different locations to monitor the sky and get high quality data on UAP if they can come across it.
Yeah, and so they want to track these interstellar bodies as they either fly close enough to us or between sun and the earth, or if they enter the atmosphere and blow up, track the explosion like they did in Papua New Guinea when they went and sort of dredged the sled through. And essentially you can capture the exploded particles of this meteorite and then through that analyze the material in the hopes that it will reveal itself to be of some kind of technology, some kind of sentient, created, man-made technology, litter. He's looking for space litter. He's looking for the Diet Coke cans thrown from, you know, a billion light years away landing on our planet, which I find really smart and interesting. Like, why not? I mean,
yeah. I mean, and it's the resistance he keeps encountering, which is the strangest. Like the fact that there's just resistance to even acknowledging that, even if they are just rocks traveling through the galaxy, there's a resistance in the scientific community to even acknowledge that these objects came from that they're extrasolar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're fighting him on the data, saying, "Well, we have no real proof that they come from outside of our solar system. These are interstellar objects." And it seems like they just don't want to give an inch that would force them to address anything to do with the UAP story.
No, no matter how weird and impossible the theory, as long as it doesn't correlate to UAP, the academic community will accept its premise. You know,
yes,
whatever they say about Oumuamua, for example, the comet that was streaking through that had a very strange shape, a very strange velocity, a very strange trajectory, all of the things that mm-hmm. just Avi was pointing out. He was just pointing it out. You know, this is weird. This could be X.
He was saying, he said, well, like a good one explanation for it could be that it is a solar sail because
mm-hmm.
it seems to be behaving like a solar sail
mm-hmm.
in that it seems to be it's being pushed. It's accelerating away from the sun as though it is being pushed by photons.
Mm-hmm.
And since solar sails are something we're currently experimenting with building, we've actually launched some as human beings. He was saying, well, you know, why wouldn't, you know, why, you know, if we assume that there is life out there and, you know, who knows how long ago this thing was launched, then the observations match what a solar sail would look like. And the rest of his peers basically were saying, just inventing any possible other explanation. I think that they were claiming it was just loosely incoherent dust particles.
Yeah.
That it was a nitrogen comet, or hydrogen comet. Then, you know, although as Avi Loeb points out, neither of those things have ever been observed before.
Yeah, everything is one in a million, right? It's just it can't be this topic. And
and he was saying even if it was those things, there would be some sort of off gassing that you would be able to detect. It would be some sort of a tail. And Oumuamua had no tail.
And again, what is wrong with asking the questions, investigating and searching for it? He is open to being proved wrong, but he also doesn't understand why we can't ask the questions.
Even like a few years ago, he said, well, if we're looking for intelligent life in the universe, and if we're looking at exoplanets, we should be looking at exoplanets and studying their atmosphere for pollution. We should be looking for industrial pollution. And he was, you know, and he was mocked and people said that, you know, said no, that no one would fund that kind of research. You know, we can't look for industrial pollutants on other planets because that's just crazy talk.
Of course. Whereas archaeology on Earth is most of the time they're finding landfills, they're finding, you know, graves, they're finding the, you know, the the remnants of everything.
Yeah.
People's the trash, and we're learning about societies and histories and cultures through what they threw away or what they, you know, piled up. So it makes perfect sense. Interstellar archaeology. I'm down with that.
Yeah.
I want to be an interstellar archaeologist.
Yeah. I mean, like Tutankhamun's tomb, what is that but a garbage dump? I mean, a really, really nice one.
I mean,
but I mean, it was just full of crap.
Beautifully constructed. It's a lot of stuff. Yeah. He didn't know. It's sort of how Christina, my wife, packs. It's just everything. Everything possibly that could go into a suitcase. He's just like, I need the donkeys. Yeah. I don't know where I'm going.
It's like,
I don't know.
Our daughter, Alina, she packs like an Oki leaving, you know, heading for California.
Well, I need, I don't know. Yeah. Just pile up the wagons. It could be, I need footmen.
That's why for Christmas, I'm getting Alina a Conestoga wagon.
Yeah. I think that's fabulous.
Yeah.
That she'll go back
get
to
around
school.
Town.
Yeah. Good idea. Okay, good.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Well, yes. So Avi was great. Great to see him.
Yes, he was great. Cool. Very generous with his time.
He was followed by...
I also love that he said we have to regard AI, because we were talking about whether AI is going to, you know, is terrifying. Where he said that we need to treat AI as though it were our child.
I like that. Yeah.
You know, which, you know, like, and as, you know, as Crosby, Stills, and Nash taught us, teach your children well.
Well, he made the point, right? Like, you just don't teach it the bad shit, or don't let it wander in bad neighborhoods by itself.
I think, and don't make it hate you.
And do what you can to try and make it not hate you. Yes, I think that's important.
Like those twins that killed their parents.
The Menendez brothers.
The Menendez. Don't turn AI into the Menendez brothers.
No.
Let's not do that.
I think they had, I mean, sounded like didn't have great parents, but not that they deserve shotgun while watching TV.
Let's not be those parents to our AI.
Humanity, not be the Menendez parents. That's okay.
I mean, I think we can acknowledge that it's the fact that most parents aren't murdered by their children is really kind of odd.
I mean, there's moments. We all have moments, right? We just don't necessarily act on them. And
I mean, I didn't murder my parents. Did you?
You know, I don't have to disclose everything. I had lovely parents. There was lots of hugs. They were very sweet, annoying sometimes, but they were very, very nice people.
But the thing is, we should set that standard in how we raise our AI, because it is going to supplant us.
It's going to do something. Now, I will say, like Luca, my son, is studying that topic. He's not as worried about it. He doesn't think it's
he's going to be its ally.
I guess maybe he'll be some sort of gatekeeper, and he'll, you know, but I think he just is like, it's just like, you know, it's like a super duper duper Google, you know, it's a very, very, very good vacuum cleaner of information and sorts it out. And I guess he hasn't gotten to the class where it, you know, wakes up and decides to nuke everybody, but I guess that's next semester. We'll see we'll see. And I'm still, you know, still paying for this shit. Beatriz Villarroel was an astronomer that spoke next after Avi, and she has this idea. It was kind of a cool talk. She was talking about these plates from the 1950s in a less crowded atmosphere.
A sky that had no artificial satellites in it.
And these,
it was our Earth sky was pristine at that point.
And they captured flashes, which were sort of attributed to UAP because they didn't show up elsewhere. They did not appear to be, as I understood it, they didn't appear to be defects in the plates, photographic defects. They were sort of tested in that capacity. Mm-hmm. And her theory or her desire was to build... Well,
Go ahead. Go on. I was just going to say that she said there were objects that appeared in the plates to be stars, but then in plates of the same patch of sky taken later... they would be gone.
Okay, right. So
sometimes in a matter of days, that what appeared to be there, she found that there were stars that disappeared.
Yes,
in short order.
Yes, and so because these things tend to be caught accidentally, the whole thing, obvious thing, really all of this is like, let's just gear our technology toward looking specifically for the things we want to see, which is a very logical approach. And her idea was to create these telescopes that would essentially, the moment like one of these flashes appeared, they would direct and target these things to capture what they are. They would be, in fact, I think, triggered by the flashes. Mm-hmm. And if they last hours or days, then... a chance to quickly zone in and study those phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. And she's already, I believe she has, they are, I guess, building those telescopes and setting them up.
They're trying to. And she was, in this case, she was looking actually for funding for some of it at least, which for a minute I went like, I was like, is that what this whole thing is? I was like, is this what this whole symposium is? Is that they're going to be kind of like, hey, we've got these, we're building these developments in, Dubai that we need to, that didn't appear to be the case. She was, there are some people that want some science funded, and that is, of course, a completely okay.
How science works.
Yeah, that's, you need some funding to do these experiments. All of these people are doing this pro bono. They are, have their day jobs as professors or academics or scientists. And so if you want to put together a really like Galileo, which is a big project, and Sol Foundation seems to be more of this kind of umbrella that wants to embrace different projects and initiatives.
A holistic scientific approach.
Yes.
And to create policy objectives, I guess, and create ways to move forward, like not just do the research, but to be able to suggest policy to governments about how to handle this.
Yeah,
subject.
It's a true think tank.
So
even though I had that moment, I was still like, that makes sense to me. It's like, how do you capture these sort of transient images? And that made perfect sense to me and seems like a worthy project and was interesting. The next talk, however, was, one of my favorites. I know one of your favorites, Kevin Knuth.
Kevin Knuth, yes.
What's his background or what's it say on his little?
Kevin Knuth, well, he's a physicist and he's working with the Coalition for Scientific Study of UAP.
Mm-hmm.
Right. A scientific coalition on UAP, SCU, I guess it's called, right?
Sounds good.
Let me put my glasses on.
Mm-hmm. So he was...
Kevin Knuth. And he's also one of the members of a group called UAPX, which is another group putting together sensors and going out and looking for evidence.
His stuff was so cool because he was basically taking like the sort of... if traditional is the right term for this phenomenon, but he took certain famous facts from sightings, for example, the Tic Tac, which was measured to have traveled about 28,000 feet from almost atmosphere to sea level in 1 second.
In 0.78 seconds.
And so what he did was sort of created mathematics algorithm to calculate the energy that would be required to go 28,000 feet in 0.78 seconds and came to the conclusion.
What would be the acceleration to the midway point and deceleration to the point of stopping, even though there was no, it was the acceleration and deceleration were not discernible, but he did the calculation to the midpoint, how fast it was going at the midpoint, and how much energy it would take to create the
stop on a dime.
To create this maneuver.
Yes.
Yeah, and to stop on a dime.
In this craft. So this has to be energy in this craft to just get an idea of what kind of technology we could be dealing with in terms of the sheer scale and scope of the energies involved. And to just make that maneuver, he concluded it would require 10 times the total nuclear power output of the United States, which seems significant to me. That's
yes. And he also, do you make the note of what he said, that for that maneuver, that its peak G-force on it was something like 5,000 Gs that it would have been?
Oh, there was another, I don't have that particular stat, but the other one I wrote down was from the Alaska sighting in 1968, where a plane.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Japan Airlines was followed for a long time by this aircraft carrier sized UAP. Enormous,
like the size of four jumbo jets.
Yes, and when this is a heavily documented, heavily witnessed. Like, here's the other thing: the stuff that they were referencing and talking about is the most censored, the most detected, the most corroborated sightings that exist. This is nobody's pulling anything out of their ass. This is all the most
object was tracked on radar,
pilots, witnesses,
witnessed by other pilots.
And in at one
probably 45 minute period.
I think it went longer, but at one point it was in front of the airplane. This craft appeared in front of it, and it was so big it just blocked out their entire view through the window. It was that huge. So it's aircraft carrier size, and it took off and was measured by every detection system that involved. So that's what Dr. Knuth was basing this on, if he's a doctor. I don't know. I'm calling them all doctors.
I'll call you
a doctor. I don't even care.
He's a PhD physicist.
There you go.
That's a doctor.
Concluded that this aircraft carrier-sized UAP was going 269,000 miles per hour. 269,000 miles per hour. At that size, when stopping, when it would stop on a dime, that energy should have created an explosion equivalent to 265 Tomahawk missiles. So to take that level of, volume of an object and accelerate it and then decelerate it at that speed, it should have caused a massive explosion. So that's the other question. Where the fuck does this energy
go? The energy go? Yeah, because when you stop, if you drive a Tesla, which you do.
I do.
When you stop, the energy from your momentum gets captured.
Yes. Recycled in.
And is used to generate more electricity. So the energy doesn't just disappear. And also, I think he calculated that one, that it was pulling 10,000 Gs.
Yeah.
I think they say the maximum we can do is something like 7 or 8?
5? Yeah, 6, 7. I don't know. I can probably do 1 G. I don't know what
we can do. So any sort of thing that we've
built, I liquefy easily.
Flies apart above that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But so 10,000 is a lot more than 7. If I'm not a mathematician.
It's a lot of pressure. I mean, we would be like wallpaper. There would be like just very thin paint left on the walls of the craft if a human was inside there.
Yeah. Well, and no craft we could build would survive those forces.
Yes.
It would be obliterated.
Billion percent.
It would explode in a ball of high temperature plasma.
Yes.
One thing from friction with the atmosphere. But these things travel at these speeds with zero friction with the atmosphere. They don't interact with the atmosphere at all.
No. And he was talking about luminosity at one point, something that a brightness would have been 30,000 megawatts. There was an one of the a USO, an underwater submersible swimming object? What do they call them?
Unidentified submersible object.
Unidentified submersible object. So there was a case in New Zealand, again, of heavily documented, of a submarine that sonar tracked an object that turned off their submarine, and it had to be rescued. And this object was traveling 1,492 miles per hour underwater.
Which is more like about twice the speed of sound.
Yeah. So
underwater.
Yeah. So these, this was just a cool, I mean, first of all, it was just a cool, for the first time, sort of hearing some mathematics applied to some of these phenomenon. Yeah. Really
to
fun.
The data.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like he was just basically putting the math to work on the data that we have.
Yeah.
For people who keep saying there is no evidence and there is no data, there is data. And it's been gathered by the military on the best sensors in the world.
And he even had the example of when your car is turned off when a UAP heads over.
Yes, which is very,
which is like a little EMP pulse. And he worked through the mechanics inside, like a starter, and inside a the mechanics of the car and how the sort of electromagnetic field that would be produced. He figured out very easy to turn the car off, but then he did this even more kind of arcane exotic math to figure out how, because in certain cases, about 20% of the cases, the car turns back on its own, which is apparently like, it stumped him. I probably wouldn't have gone so deep into these woods myself with these questions because I wouldn't think to ask them, but he was like, why does it turn back on in 20% of the cases?
Yeah, because and it's a great thing is he says it's not magic. He basically said there was, you know, some sort of a magnetic field will be built up in the circuit, and then when the craft disappears, that magnetic field would be released, and that would cause current in the conductors,
but only in about 20% of the cases as that
yes,
and then added up. Entirely.
How many times that happens?
With the percentages in the case of reported cases where this. So I thought that was really a kind of cool.
Where the car gets shut down and then restarts itself. He said the number of it's 20. Yeah, exactly 20% of the cases. Because he actually calculated that you how many times he would have to cope. Like what the likelihood is that this electric current could be started up at the exact time that the pistons have fuel in them, and that the spark plugs fire. Mm-hmm. And he calculated that for all of these things to coincide, it would probably happen 20% of the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that exactly correlated with the accounts of how many times cars start themselves.
Yeah.
And he also said that in Close Encounters, the truck wouldn't have been turned off.
Yeah, for some reason, the truck wouldn't apply. It would
diesel,
have to be a
diesels.
Diesel.
Yeah, it's different. So if you're going to drive under UFOs, be sure you're driving a diesel. Yeah.
Get your shit together, people.
So you can make it home.
Yeah, his theme was sort of unfamiliar engineering can look like anomalous physics.
Yes. Well, I think he kept saying, he held up the cell phone and said, this is not physics. The phone, It works because of physics, but it is not physics. It is engineering. And that engineering is a way to get around problems in physics, to solve problems in physics. And so he said, so when he sees all of these weird things like the Tic Tac, that it's not evidence to him of new physics, but it is evidence of new engineering, mm-hmm. of better engineering than we currently have. That they may be able to figure out ways around these problems.
Yeah. And he sort of set up that kind of teed up Gary Nolan, mm-hmm. Who was sharing with us kind of spectroscopy.
Yes.
Basically just taking pictures of really, really, really small stuff. Down to, mm-hmm. I don't know, microns and kind of things, yes. of material.
Bits of metals. And
these were materials given to him by Jacques Vallée that were from famous crashes or famous reported explosions or landing sites of UAPs, yes. including the Ubatuba sighting.
Mm-hmm. Where some sort of a sphere sort of exploded over a beach, and all the fishermen saw this thing, and there was this molten metal was dropped down onto the beach,
right,
and was recovered by, and also the very famous Lonnie Zamora sighting in Socorro, New Mexico. The police officer who saw what, you know, sort of a, as he described it, an egg-shaped craft, mm-hmm, that had two beings emerge from it and walk around, and that, you know, who then got back in their craft and flew away because they went, you know, jiggers, it's the cops.
Let's go. Get out of here.
Yeah.
This was, so these were kind of very famous, this was materials from very famous cases. Mm-hmm. In our sort of second episode of recap, we'll talk about the exchange that Jacques Vallée had about his materials with a gentleman named Carl Nell, which was a really, yes, really interesting interaction. But yeah. So Professor Nolan, who I don't think he likes me, Dave. I mean, we can also get into that later.
I don't think he likes either of us.
I think he likes you, probably.
They invited us to the event.
I don't know if he knew I was there. I don't think he likes. We can get into that later. I'm very insecure about that. But I like him, and I think he's doing a hell of a job.
He's brilliant.
And there's just some people. Do you ever have that person that you kind of like, you want to sort of impress them or what, but you keep kind of sort of shit in the bed when you sort of talk with them? This is what I feel is going on.
That's how I feel about everyone, pretty much. I feel that way about everyone I meet all the time.
No, I wouldn't say that. Yeah. No, we don't have that. You and I don't have that with each other. Maybe some moments.
But I have social anxiety.
Me too. But this was a bad place to have social anxiety because that, like, everybody there is a little spectrum-y. There's nobody's really accommodating anything. Like, this is a lot of like banging heads, people, you know.
Yeah. You know what's rarer there than an explanation for UAP?
What?
Eye contact.
It's a hard room to.
You're dealing with
some characters. So that was, it wasn't like a free flowing, although people were doing very well. And we kind of picked up our game in the second day, I think. I was doing a lot of.
Well, we met a lot of very interesting people.
Wonderful people. You know? Very cool people. Yeah. But
Gary, there was some,
he had put together this research fairly quickly, or so he said. He had gotten the data back on like that Friday or something, and he showed us some very cool pictures. He was not claiming that what he was showing us, which was essentially this, as I understood it, this pure silicon. It was arranged in a way that clearly it was industrial material, clearly engineered. Yeah. Is what he said. It was clearly engineered. He said it was not impossible that it could be human engineering, that it is, you know, it was a very exotic way to put the materials together. But let us remind the audience that these were coming from crash sites or sites of reported exploding UAP. So that does tend to weigh
and going back to the 50s.
Yes.
Good
point. Yeah. So piling silicon.
People who have had the technology, the industrial processes to manufacture these materials that are clearly very exotic.
Right.
And as you said, would be massively expensive to produce.
Yes. Yes.
And why would anyone produce them? And if you're going to produce these massively expensive metals, why would you produce them just to dump them on a beach in front of fishermen?
Good points. All good points.
What's the upside?
I don't know.
What's the upside of that?
I'm not sure.
You know,
I don't even know what. I thought sand was silicon
for a hoax. Yeah, for a hoax. I mean, it just seems like a lot of money to spend on a hoax.
Yeah,
that you then never take credit for.
Yeah, I think hoaxes will occur photographically on Twitter or whatever, but. These are pretty, you know, we're talking, speaking of this, these were Jacques Vallée's material and he was the next speaker.
Yeah. But Gary Nolan, the summary of what he was saying is that it appears that like humans, what we do, in our chemistry, and in our metallurgy is we work with elements. We combine elements, the periodic table. We take them and we mix them and match them and, you know, galvanize and do whatever we want with them. But that whoever was building these things also appear to be using isotopes in the same way that we use elements. That they are using, that they're combining unique, you know, isotopic ratios.
Does that mean
to create a different materials?
Combination of elements?
Well, no, it's like taking elements, but elements with different isotopes, meaning, I guess, you know, different sort of numbers of I guess, was it protons or
don't fucking even start with me. Atom? I don't, you know.
But it's basically like, that you know, I mean, we can do that. We can create materials with different isotopic ratios, but again, hugely expensive and complicated, and we don't really know why you would bother to do it because we don't know what the benefit is. But he said whoever made these materials seems to be manipulating isotopes in the same way we manipulate elements to create new and unique properties in the materials. And he said, this is, you know, so he said, maybe that's one of the things we'll learn from the UAP studies is that we'll learn how to do that, you know, and maybe we'll be able to combine, you know, find that this combination of isotopes maybe creates a room temperature superconductor or a waveguide that maybe gives you the ability to cloak, you know, that we could learn, you know, if we can learn what they're doing with these isotopes and why they're doing it, then we might be able to do that as well. So that to me was a very interesting
very
point
cool.
that he brought up.
No, I know. Yeah. Fascinating.
And then he said, there's only two people here I don't like.
He didn't say that, but he was thinking
he did. Said it with his eyes.
I talk about avoiding eye contact. That's what I was doing with him.
And he kept saying, and if you have questions, just come up to me. You know what I'm like. I'm easy like Sunday morning. Just come up and chat. I'm all open. You know what? And I love a hug.
Yeah.
The
backstory to that is in my UAP infancy, which was really only about a year ago. Always very curious about it, but I reached out to Professor Nolan, really to talk to him about ostensibly a working on something that would would involve this topic because it was so intriguing to me. But I was it was like talking to him, like you gotta be on your game. Plus, it was like jumping in a river of names and places and events and things that I just had not yet fully absorbed into my system. I dragged you along. So it became a kind of dress rehearsal for our podcast.
Yes. Yes. Cause we talked to him for over an hour on
we
Zoom.
Did. He was very, very nice to give us his time. And at one point he was like, what are we doing here?
Maybe he thought we got him on there under false pretenses. Cause one of the things you talked about was that you wanted to write a movie on the subject.
I do.
And yes, and I think he thought he was being brought in maybe to consult on a movie.
He can. But I was vague. My whole thing, I was very vague, and I shouldn't.
Yeah, but maybe he feels we misled him.
Well, I hope not, because that would never be my intent. But that's why he doesn't like me. Is that what you're saying?
He invited us, but we got invited. I mean,
listen, and
there weren't a lot of showbiz people there. There were not a lot of showbiz folk there. There was that one other writer.
They were with us. Hey,
Matt. Matt, what was Matt's last name?
Matt Cook.
Matt Cook, yes.
Great. Yeah.
So he's a writer.
He is. I'd love to have him on. He has a fascinating story.
But there weren't. I mean, I was the only comedian in the room.
That is true.
No, there was no Patton Oswalt there.
I didn't see Patton.
Zach Galifianakis wasn't there.
I sure as hell didn't see no Galifianakis in that room. Listen, because you're a titan, and you're also you're a bridge. Bridge between worlds.
I'm saying they picked one comedian in the entire world.
That was you. That was you.
I guess, yeah.
And I was kind of along for the ride.
You know, they couldn't get Adam Sandler.
Yeah. Listen, I think like where we are is there is a lot to talk about on the B side of this.
Yes.
We've got speakers in day one. We still have to get to.
We've reached the end of page one of day one.
This was a lot of shit going on. This was one of the most mind-blowing weekends of my life in terms of just the sheer amount of information to absorb, the concepts to absorb, because this as it was said multiple times, we're in the middle of disclosure. Like disclosure has begun.
It has started. Yes.
This feels like it was a very big part of it. And whether or not the mainstream media wants to pay any attention to it, it's like academia, the sciences, the government, it's all underway. And
yes,
this and is crazy.
Which we'll get to Carl Nell in the
big time
future conversation
big time
coming up very soon.
So listen, thank you for joining us for part one of our Saul Foundation recap. And Dave, good work.
Thank you.
You were really on. You were really on today. I just want to say
that was that was an amazing weekend and a lot to absorb.
Yes, and we have much more to download. My mind remains blown, and so tune in next week to Really with Tom and Dave. And if you liked our conversation today, please like and subscribe. If you didn't like our conversation, please like and subscribe anyway.
Yeah. How's it going to hurt you?
Yeah. What does it take? I mean,
I only have so many likes and subscribes. Clicks in my life.
Yeah, no, you've got bottoms.
It's not like that. It's not like heartbeats. We all know we only have so many heartbeats. You know, when you use them up, you die.
True.
So you shouldn't exercise because you're
correct.
You're racing through your heartbeats.
Well, it actually makes your heartbeat slow down. But okay, we can talk about this. But
it's just science.
I'm going to see you on the other side. We're going to keep going.
Yeah,
this is fun.
Okay.
Bye, all. Thank you.